From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast, is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History. We've got a bit of an episode with a difference for you today. We're dropping in someone else's podcast, but that's because A, it's really good, and B, it's because I'm on it. So it all makes sense. Go with it, folks. It's a show that I've been a fan of for a long time called We Didn't Start the Fire. It's a history podcast inspired by the lyrics. It's a really good idea. This really annoys me. It's inspired by the lyrics of the Billy Joel song, We Didn't Start the Fire. And if you remember, it starts like Harry Truman, Doris Day, Red China, Johnny Ray. It's a gallop through the history of his life. And this podcast are going through it line by line with people explaining what every single reference is. It's such a good idea. The one I'm about to play is very special because I talked to the great Katie Puckrick and Tom Fordyce about the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, which was in 1954 in Vietnam. As you all know, because you all love history, it was the nemesis of French Empire in Asia. It was a catastrophic defeat for the French and ended up with them leaving Southeast Asia. It also led to the downfall of the French government. I mean, it's big, big repercussions. And if any place on earth really symbolizes the end of this era of European empire, it's probably Dien Bien Phu, high in the hills of what is now northern Vietnam. It was really fun to record this. I've always been fascinated by this story. I've been to Vietnam several times. I think this is a fascinating battlefield, a fascinating story. I thought you might like to hear it too. And of course, go and check out their other episodes if you want. Let's do them a favor. They got everything from Einstein, North Korea, Nixon, Catcher in the Rye. Obviously, just search We Didn't Start the Fire in your podcast app and do all that following and subscribing and stuff. Anyway, here is We Didn't Start the Fire with Katie Puckrick, Tom Fordyce, and me.
This is We Didn't Start the Fire, the only podcast started by me, Billy Joel.
Joseph Stalin,
Malenkov,
Nasser,
Emperor Kafia,
Rockefeller,
Campanella,
Communist Bloc,
Roy Cohn,
Wampuran,
Toscanini,
Dacron,
Dien Bien Phu Falls.
Easy for you to say, Katie.
Oh, it wasn't that easy.
Hello and welcome to episode 39 of We Didn't Start the Fire, the podcast that is history through a Billy Joel number one hit. All the people, places and moments that shaped our world, the ones racing for space, turning up the Cold War heat, building things up and knocking them down. I'm Tom Fordyce.
I'm Katie Puckrick.
Shall we start some fires, Katie?
Oh, I can't wait. Now, today's fire involves a term that I can barely say. Dien Bien Phu Falls is the lyric, and Dien Bien Phu is a place, Tom. Did you know that?
Katie, when I first saw the lyric Dien Bien Phu Falls, I thought it might be a tourist attraction, some lovely waterfalls somewhere in the Far East, and I was very wrong.
Very wrong. Now, there is somebody who's going to put us on the path of correctness, and I'm really looking forward to this. He is Dan Snow, historian and host of the beloved History Hit podcast. History Hit! Dan, hi.
Hey, and by the way, can I just stop you there?
No.
It is a great tourist attraction. What the hell do you guys do on vacation? Waterfalls. The first thing I did when I went to Vietnam was go to Dien Bien Phu.
Did you go to the Coochie Tunnels?
Of course I did.
Yeah. Could you get in them?
No, I got stuck.
Dan, I don't know if you know this, but your aunt, the historian Margaret McMillan, has already been forging a trail here on We Didn't Start the Fire.
Get out of here.
She was our expert for the H-Bomb show and the England's Got a New Queen.
That's so cool.
Yeah, so you have some big stilettos to fill here. Dien Bien Phu refers to the pivotal battle of the First Indochina War and the Viet Minh's victory over the colonial French. You had their hindquarters kicked six ways to Sunday. But to get there, we got to rewind. What were the origins of the conflict, Dan?
In 1914, 85% of the world's population was governed by Europeans. European empires covered nearly every part of the globe. There's very, very few bits of the globe. China, for example, bits of China, which didn't have, were not incorporated into European empires. After the Second World War, this process completely unravels. You get decolonization. And in previous bouts of decolonization, like when the Roman Empire falls, you know about it, right? There's guys crossing the Rhine, they're smashing the place up. When the Abbasid Empire falls in Baghdad, the Mongols turn up, wrap the last caliph in a rug, trample him to death, burn the library, destroy the whole place. You know about it. The European empires mainly go out with a kind of weird whimper. The British just leave India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, that kind of area, Burma. They realise it's just no point going on anymore, apart from the French. Apart from the French. The French put up one hell of a fight. And as a result, at Dien Bien Phu, you get the only example in the 20th century of these European empires retreating or falling at the end of a bayonet. They are beaten out of Vietnam. They don't go of their own accord. They don't reluctantly leave like the Brits do in various places like Nigeria. They are thrashed by an indigenous army. It's the only time a modern European army is thrashed like this in this period. So it's come to sort of symbolise this moment of decolonisation. And the French are, as you said, on the receiving end. So that's the kind of background. The background is that after France fell in 1940, in one of the most catastrophic military campaigns of all time, in a matter of a couple of weeks, those Germans, all nibbling on their speed pills, marched across France, one and the other, very, very quickly indeed, set all the world records. Anyway, so Southeast Asia was all French Empire, Laos, and what we now Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, stuff. The Japanese moved in there after the French fell to the Germans. The Japanese kind of moved in to deal with their that part of the world. And then in 1945, because the French wanted to kind of reassert their manliness in the world, so their vitality, they go, look, we're back. We're back in the game. We're still a great power. They decided they were going to go all in, getting back their empire in Southeast Asia. And it went badly. It turned into this like grueling, miserable, attritional guerrilla war, which we come to recognise so much now in the 20th century and 21st. And the French thought, we know what we'll do. We'll bring things to a head. We're going to fight a big old battle. We're going to win. This is it. This is the end of our problems.
And just looking a little bit before Dien Bien Phu, at the warring factions. I think it's very interesting that you had a very dissolute and random cast of characters who were fighting on behalf of the Vietnamese and also the French. So you had like leftover Japanese soldiers.
Crazy, yeah.
Yeah, and then you had some Axis powers, like former SS officers coming in on behalf of the French Foreign Legion.
A lot of people in 1945. Who didn't really want to go and have their day in court? Okay, they'd done some things. They'd been on the losing side, and they'd done some things. They'd done something they shouldn't have done. And so, if you're a Japanese soldier officer and you've been committing war crimes anywhere across Japan's giant Asian empire, you find a way to slip out, change your uniform, and go and support whoever's in town. By the same token, lots of German, amazingly SS. Obviously, some slope way to Argentina, but many joined the French Foreign Legion, particularly, of course, because a big chunk of what the Germans thought of a Germany Alsace-Lorraine has now been incorporated back into France. These are actually French citizens now who've been fighting for the Third Reich, often in SS units. So they were part of this motley crew, a little bit like Iraq in our lifetime. Sometimes there's a situation and mercenaries are required, volunteers are required, and they kind of suck in all the baddest people on the planet. Like a lot of dodgy South African mercenaries turn up in Iraq and Basra, in Baghdad, in the early 21st century. And obviously we know about the other side, all the kind of Mujahideen folks go. So yeah, it's a little bit, it is a bit like that.
So it's like getting the band back together, but it's like a tour, like a you know, super group, if you will.
It's like a super group of just evil people.
Hateful people.
Of hateful people.
Yeah.
Who just gravitate towards where there are guns, money, and license to commit atrocities and things.
And by the time of this battle, Dan, in 1954, what is the state of play? Are France losing heavily? Is this one final hurrah, or do they feel like they're on top?
So you've got Ho Chi Minh, who's this legendary father of the Vietnamese people. He was Vietnamese, he travelled to France, he applied to work in the French colonial administration. He's one of these many kind of characters you get in this time, not unlike some of the Indian leaders of independence, not unlike Aung San Suu Kyi's father. They're sort of, they kind of initially think, well, fine, if we're one great happy empire, multinational empire, let me get involved. And then they experience racism and pushback in the colonial centre. And he realises that the French Empire is actually just, it's just basically French white supremacy. And he gets ready. So while he's in France, he's washing dishes, he's doing jobs, he travels on ships, he goes to America, we think, and Britain. He lived in Ealing for a while. He becomes an anti-imperialist and he joins the Socialist Party and eventually is attracted to communism. But mostly because it was an engine of decolonization. He just didn't really want the French running Vietnam anymore. And the tragedy of this whole thing is he admired George Washington. He admired Western kind of liberal republicanism. We now think we can be clever after the people that knew him said, look, he'd have been cool with, if the French leave Vietnam, he'd have been pretty happy to be sort of be on a kind of liberal capitalist basis. But he found the only place he'd get a hearing, he wrote these letters to Truman, he wrote letters to people, they all ignored him. The only place to get a hearing is the communist bloc. And they were like, yeah, we hate the Western sort of capitalist empires.
So he reached out to President Truman in the U.S.
Yeah, he reached out and he went to the Treaty of Versailles. He was willing to engage in Treaty of Versailles, and of course everyone ignored him because of basically this kind of inherent racism at the world at that time and the idea that these people were incapable of governing themselves. And so he eventually goes to a place where he could get guns, he'd get money, get support, and that was communism. So, and then of course once you, as we see with President Nasser in Egypt all through the Cold War, once you kind of I'll take that call. The Americans like whack you on the list. So then suddenly you're like a terrorist. Suddenly you're like, oh, okay. So you're forced constantly to take sides, like the X-Men films. And so he ends up with his brilliant commander, Jap, at fighting an insurgency. Classic insurgency. They've got people, they've got supplies, they travel light, they've got new technology, means you carry things like assault rifles that can do a huge amount of damage and don't require massive logistical chains to support them. It's the kind of thing we see around the world in the 20th century. We see it famously in Vietnam a decade later, but we see it right here in the 50s. It's just a total pain in the arse for the French. They're not losing, but they're not winning. And in an insurgency, if you're not winning, you are losing. Unless you're restoring order, you're bleeding money. You've got people at home going, let's have a national health service, effectively. And you're just going, no, what I think is really important is we're restoring French rule in the jungles of northern Indochina, right? So it's unpopular in France, ironically. And so the French government, French authorities in Vietnam say what lots of people have always said. It's what you do when you get a bit desperate. It's what Hitler did at the beginning of the Second World War. You seek a decisive confrontation because you think, I'm not going to win the long haul. We're getting ground down here. What we want is to bring this all to a climax in a dramatic and decisive confrontation that will allow me to overturn the kind of odds and win. And it's very attractive. You can see it's very attractive. I mean, we all think, yeah, that's much more fun than just going, let's build a whole network of roads and rural police stations and slowly try and educate people and bring food security to the outlying areas and convince them that French colonial rule is better. Not super exciting. We're going to stick 6,000 bad men into this valley in North Vietnam, cut off Viet Minh, the rebel supply lines, take the fight into their heartlands, and then bring them in, set ourselves up almost as vulnerable in this kind of rural valley. They'll think, right, let's come in for the kill. And we want them to do that because then we will annihilate them.
So they had their strategy all mapped out, but what were their misconceptions?
Well, the misconception was that every time you seek decisive battle, the other side might just say yes.
Might be their decisive battle.
It might be decisive battle, but not in the way you intended. So the plan was really good up until the point at which the French had underestimated the Vietnamese war fighting capability. So they said, we'll occupy this valley. There's high peaks around it. It's in the middle of jungle. It's near their supply. It's sort of not the obvious place for us to want to fight a modern battle, which requires modern war, folks. People talk all the time about sort of heroism and valor on the battlefield and leadership and speeches. It's irrelevant, really. It's irrelevant. It's not irrelevant. It's not them. It's not as important as something else, which is logistics. You need bombs and you need bullets and you need shells and you need food and you need cans, you need oil, petrol, and you need aircraft parts. And so it's a bit weird for the French to disappear off to the most remote part of Vietnam, set up this weird base that is vulnerable to fire from the hills around it, and think that they're going to fight this giant battle from there.
But they had an airfield, though.
An airfield, though. So they were like, the Vietnamese, this is so clever. They'll think, they will be dangling a little ripe, juicy target the Vietnamese will not be able to say no to. And they will do what guerrillas never do, which is stop, coming in ones and twos at night and stabbing this bloke and blowing up that post office. We want to get them all in the same place, and then we can smash them with our crazy Western armour and our firepower and our bombs and our machine guns. That's what we want. We need the guerrillas to come out of their hiding places. And that's what we're going to offer ourselves up as a target. We've built a runway, and all night and every day our planes will take off from this airfield and napalm them and blow them to pieces, right? And we will win. We will win this war, this unwinnable war. We will win, and we'll show those politicians in Paris that I'm talking about and all those liberals and intelligentsia people who are dissing us, and we will show that France can be great again.
Now, as you describe it like that, Dan, I can imagine a table, probably a circular table. There are French generals all the way around the outside, and I can imagine them standing up and cheering because it sounds like an amazing plan. But once they actually get to Dien Bien Phu, I imagine they changed their minds because when I first read about this, Katie, in my head, it's a huge garrison already. It's a spectacular fortress. It's a vast town. Maybe it's even a city. Rather than this very weird setup, Dan, where you've got five or six or seven disparate little bases that all look like they can be picked off one at a time.
There you go. Military, we've got, here we go, military strategist over. You spotted the problem immediately. Yeah, this is not a fortress at Verdun. This is not the Maginot Line. This is not a kind of gigantic fortifications that you expect, you know, Hitler to try and build to stop the Soviet army in 1943, 44. This is just, it's a weird plan. Look, fundamentally, they're racist. They used to refer to the Vietnamese in racially derogatory ways. They assumed that they were incapable of fighting modern war, positional warfare on the scale. So what they do is they build an airstrip and they surround it with little dots, each one apparently named after the mistresses of this kind of really charismatic and brilliant aristocratic general who was in charge of Castries.
So French.
And I say brilliant. And of course, actually turns out not to be brilliant at all. But he thought, this is great. We'll have all these little fire bases. They're mutually supporting, i.e. their guns can sort of cover each other. And so key thing, as you point out, is airfield in the middle, air power. It's the answer to Western strategists' fever dreams, because the Viet Minh don't have air power. They have jet aircraft capable of dropping, you know, precision munitions. And it sort of doesn't really work.
You say it doesn't really work. There is one image, Katie, and that's when they decide to drop a bulldozer out of an aeroplane.
With a parachute attached to
with
it,
with a
right?
parachute attached. Yeah, nice. Unfortunately, misses the landing zone and ends up in a paddy field.
Yeah, in a rice paddy, and whoops, well, you can't use that anymore. It's just waterlogged. Too bad. They ended up having to parachute not only bulldozers, but, you know, arm supplies, men, because what happened to that airfield?
This is a critical moment. They got everything wrong in that the Viet Minh, the Vietnamese rebels, were able to assemble a vast stockpile of very modern weapons, but using the most primitive form, which is humans carrying it all. And of course, not to underestimate the probably the most important decisive weapon of the battle, which was a bicycle.
Yeah.
So through the jungle canopy, you can create these trails from their supply bases, and you can move an astonishing amount of men and material. And there's young children carrying, there's women as working as porters, and you can filter through the forest. When there is a successful airstrike, if and when they do happen, you simply move out. And there's no—you haven't built a particularly road, you haven't built big concrete bridges, steel reinforced. It's brutal, and no European would think of doing it because, they're frankly, we've lost that kind of that agrarian toughness that you'd expect in terms of porterage. You know that we rely on vehicles, Europeans.
Yeah, we're soft.
We've gone very soft, right?
Yeah.
The French rely on motor vehicles transport, so they look at their enemy and think they'll never be able to tow 10-ton guns up through this jungle to mountainous positions to then rain down fire on this base. It's impossible. How are you going to do it? Well, they do it because they disassemble them, they carry them,
and
they drag them.
They dig ditches, don't they?
They dig ditches, they hide them.
Yeah.
That's a very good point. So you can't see it all happening under the jungle canopy.
It's sort of like under street level, so to speak.
They dig enormous tunnels and through the hillsides. They've got a lot of support, we should say. So the Americans have started giving the French a lot of money and support here. It's the classic Cold War proxy war thing going on, the puppet masters. We've got China and USSR pouring money and supplies towards the Viet Minh. The Viet Minh got lots of people, 50,000 people or so, but they get heavy guns from the Chinese, often captured in the Korean War, by the way. It's just finished slightly earlier.
Well, you know, they're recycling. Why not?
They're recycling.
Very green.
They're using shells. It must have been dispiriting to get, you know, Western manufactured shells raining down on the French. And so you're just carrying, that is the logistics is what is the beginning, middle and end of this story. You open fire on these French bases. You shock the French. They cannot believe they are receiving this this volume and intensity of fire. But then you've got to send, unfortunately, in war, you do have to send in the lads to fight at close quarters, get across that barbed wire. And there is unimaginably brutal hand-to-hand fighting. And one by one, these outlying bases are picked off. You listen to me talking about Dien Bien Phu. More coming up.
Hey, I'm Don Wildman, and on American History Hit, my expert guests and I journey across the nation and through the years to uncover the stories that have made the United States. From first flight to first ladies, From stitching the Star-Spangled Banner to striking gold in California to shooting for the moon with Apollo. We've got you covered. Catch new episodes of American History Hit, a podcast by History Hit, every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when using messaging apps, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage, add unlimited photos and videos, and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AURAframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
And the story, Dan, of how these outlying bases are picked off seems to follow a similar pattern where there is a certain haplessness in the leadership on the ground and an inability to work out what is happening around them. Then a large degree of heroism from the people defending that particular base and then ultimately a capitulation.
Yeah, so that's fair. I think although we should say the Viet Minh perform brilliantly there as well. So we shouldn't blame, again, it's tempting to be as a European, sort of blame everything on the Europeans. I mean, I think, not sure the French could do anything differently really, but the plan was flawed and the people on the ground then had to live with that and go through the almost inevitable tragedy that unfolded. So yeah, so you bring down massive fires. You said, Katie, the tunnels being built. So it's very like the First World War. You inch forward trenches, you've got unlimited manpower and woman power. So you're digging these unbelievably long trenches. The airstrip is put out of action by the artillery fire that the Vietnamese have managed to achieve. And from that moment, they're just done. It's done. It's only a matter of time. But so the artillery fire is smashing the airfield. It's smashing these outlying bases, bringing down unbelievable torrents of fire that no French army was ever expecting from these Asian peasant volunteer guerrilla forces.
Yeah, women and children on Peugeot bicycles.
Right, so what are they doing firing 105mm shells in extraordinary quantities? No, it's not cool. It's not meant to happen, right? So then, also, because they've got limited manpower, having attrited, having ground out, you haven't let them sleep, you haven't defended these bases sleep, you've pounded them, you haven't let them repair their defences, you then send infantry in waves, outnumbering them 10 to 1. Mm. So waves of humans, like the First World War, we say, oh, Battle of Somme, terrible, you know, incompetent generals. Well, that's exactly what General Giap does in this conflict. He softens up the French and then he sends these overwhelming waves of human wave attacks at these little bases. Each one that falls, you then get a foothold and you then make the other base untenable because they're all mutually reinforcing. The trouble is they're all mutually, it's pretty destructive when one part falls like a cancer. It will start to spread through the whole system.
And wasn't there a moment where the U.S. Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, offers the French two atomic bombs?
Well, this is the big debate. There's a moment. But you're right. Things get so desperate. I mean, one of the worst moments, it's very early on. It's just after the first two forts fall within a day. The artillery commander at the base, like Mr. Artillery, who's meant to be bringing down, you know, fire on the Vietnamese and winning this decisive battle, he takes a hand grenade into his tent and blows himself up, which is bad for morale.
No, there's
bad
not
for
a
him
lot of
as well.
Well, it's bad for him.
Not a lot of confidence.
Yeah, it's like, how's the leadership doing? Well, so then the French panic and go to the Americans and say, listen, these guys are communists. You know, communists, right? We don't like these guys.
Yeah, remember, you don't like them
remember,
either.
Yeah, it's like, you know. And,
that's the trigger word.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good bit of branding. But they were communists by that stage, and they were being helped by the Chinese, of course. So the Americans, Nixon, predictably, and Dulles, the Secretary of State, was quite hawkish. And the French say, this might be a lost in translation moment, the French say that Dulles floated the idea of atomic weapons being used. So by this stage, so-called tactical nuclear weapons, because The insanity of mankind knows no bounds. And after dropping the nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, what the US military thought was, these are great, but they're a bit clumsy. Mm. You know what? They wipe out in Hollywood. What we need is stuff that we can actually use on the battlefield. They made atomic things that are remarkably smaller than what we might think. They made like atomic handheld weapons.
Oh, like
what?
Portable, like low-cal.
Yeah, exactly. So you could just sort of, like, you know, almost throw a hand grenade, almost, but it'll have an atomic yield. Like, it was just it was seen as a brilliant bit of new technology that would just obviously, like, expand the killing capability of individuals on the battlefield. So there were so-called tactical weapons where you would be able to just nuke quite a small area, but you would absolutely be able to destroy it. And then the French would be able to take that terrain straight after. So they did those nuclear tests you may have seen out in the people watching them in Vegas with the sort of funny glasses on. And they would have, what they'd do is they'd drop an atomic weapon and then people would get out their trenches straight away and march over that terrain and take it, quote unquote. And of course, they suffered terrible health complications and disasters both at the time and ever since. But, well, whatever Dulles suggested, the Americans decided not to do it because it would be potentially catastrophic.
But they did throw some money. The U.S. Paid for about 80% of the supplies, didn't they, for the French?
Very much so. Very much so, yeah. I mean, the Americans, when you're kind of globally hegemonic power like the Brits were in the 19th century or the Americans were in the 20th century, it's a great expression. The Brits, people hate the Brits in the 19th century because they basically throw money at problems without having to get their own hands dirty. So this famously one European said, the British are willing to fight the death of the last Austrian. Because basically, the Austrians had a limited manpower, just loads of them, right? And obviously, Austro-Hungarian Empire really big in those days. And the Brits just keep sending money, going, please raise more armies, fight Napoleon. We can't do it ourselves, but here's some cash. And so, yeah, anyway, so in a similar way, the Americans found themselves fighting through these proxies, and obviously, famously, you know, whether it's in Africa, whether it's supporting the French in Indochina, and then when that falls through, the Americans then decide they're gonna get involved themselves. But yeah.
At what point does America realise that it might have backed the wrong horse here?
Well, it's very clear when these bases just inexorably fall, the airstrip gets put out of action. So the French, even if they had a plan, they can no longer use their plan to use tactical air power, fighter bombers, to destroy the troops on the ground, Viet Minh on the ground, partly because they can't see them, partly because the airstrip doesn't work anymore. It's a horror show. So slowly, it's inexorable. They just capture one after the other. They just grind closer and closer. And there's this amazing kind of radio communications between them and their HQ in Hanoi. And so it becomes, it's a slow motion. It's a relatively slow motion catastrophe. It plays out over about a month.
And what is the radio communication?
There was a conversation between Castri and his French superior in Hanoi. And that's amazing because at that stage, he tells him, do not surrender. On any account, do not surrender.
So they're like, please, can we just flash that white flag? Because we've run out of tricks.
And the bloke who's sitting in probably a nice colonial mansion in Hanoi with probably a glass of claret. He's had a nice lunch. He's got his feet up on the desk.
A cigar.
Yeah, lads, don't surrender under any circumstances. See you later.
Yeah, all the best. And what's amazing about that is people... bullshit that people come up with when they're in senior positions of military and political power is like, that's exactly what Hitler said at Stalingrad. These people think, you know, surrendering will be worse than everyone being killed and taken. Like, it's just nonsense. Like, how do they come up with this mad stuff? Like, so he is told, for purely political purposes, fight the last man, the last bullet, and then we'll try and turn it into a national myth, right? Which is what Hitler does at Stalingrad. It's like, it's not going to be a national myth, brother. That's like Plan D, and it's a crap plan. So they pay for this with their lives. I've always found it really chilling. There's a radio transmission from somebody going, the enemy troops are outside my headquarters. Every position has been overrun. It's the last words are, the enemy has overrun us. We are blowing up everything. Vive la France. It's just so grim. And again, just to come back, like the fighting there was as bad as anything that you guys will imagine the First World War being like. It's also during a monsoon. It's a tropical monsoon. So the mud, the intensity is, and the hand-to-hand nature of it. And of course, the kind of hatred, I think, given an extra layer of racial antipathy going on there as well.
And what an utter humiliation for the French. How did they deal with that?
Not well. They agreed the party was over in Vietnam. So by July, French Empire in South Asia is over. The government has collapsed. It's the end of a kind of a vision of the world in which European empires dominated. It actually fomented, the news of it got back to Algeria, was literally considered to be a piece of France at that point, Algeria, and the first Riots as uprisings against French rule occurred within weeks of news arriving Dien Bien Phu. Algeria would see the French embroiled in another appalling insurgency, criminality and atrocities committed, and led to a military putsch against the French government. It led to the fall of the Fourth Republic and the return of Charles de Gaulle as a sort of national figure of salvation. So, I mean, the answer is few battles have had bigger political ramifications, I think, than this one. So I think the French came at about 1,000 dead, 1,000 lost, which effectively dead, and then 4,000 people wounded to greater and lesser extent. And the Vietnamese, we just don't know, but over 20,000. So astonishing, astonishing sacrifice. Those numbers aren't huge compared to some of the numbers, for example, the battles of First World War, of course. But it's a good example of military, where military and politics is not about scale sometimes. It's about, this is one of the most decisive battles of the 20th century, even though it was, I mean, quite small, but there was nothing small about it for the people involved.
So, Tom, the Vietnamese say that it took 1,000 years to be rid of the Chinese, 70 years to be rid of the French, and 15 years to be rid of the USA. So, Dan, this failure at Dien Bien Phu leads the U.S. into 10 years of the Vietnam War, or the American War, as the Vietnamese knew it as.
Yeah, and Dien Bien Phu was uppermost. I mean, they were obsessed with Dien Bien Phu. In fact, President Johnson, there was a sort of strangely similar situation at a firebase called Khe San, where also Americans had an airfield and they tried to tempt the Vietnamese to attack it. And the Vietnamese did. And in fact, there, the Americans did unleash unimaginable casualties on the Vietnamese attackers. So, but Johnson freaked out about Khe San and he built a model of it in the White House basement and went down there every day and used to say, people over here and heard him talking to himself, says, I don't want no Dien Bien Phu. Yeah, he was a Texan accent, which I won't attempt, but he talked about Dien Bien Phu a lot. And it is a spectre that haunts anybody fighting complex insurgencies in the so-called, you know, the Third World for decades to come.
Why does America then not look at what happened to the French and think, hang on,
Yeah. This
looks like an awful place to fight against people who are doing things that are almost impossible to counteract.
Asymmetrical.
Do you know
warfare.
What? We might just have a little bit of chats here. This might be George or not war.
Because unfortunately, we are not very good. We back ourselves, don't we? And we probably think, well, so-and-so's had a go before, but they're crap compared to us.
Right.
And we will do everything correct. So you see that in Afghanistan. I mean, you know, why did the Americans invade Afghanistan in 2001?
After the Soviets had such a tough time.
Literally 15 years before.
Yeah.
But the answer was, well, because we got, you know, smart weapons and all the new stuff and GPS and cool stuff and we'll be fine. So there is a kind of myopia there. But there is also a bigger point, which is they knew it was an inauspicious place to go and fight, but they felt it was absolutely essential because this idea of a domino theory of these states of Southeast Asia, South Asia falling one by one to communism. The Chinese Civil War and the victory of the communists in China is regarded as the greatest American foreign policy mistake of all time, virtually, even though China specialists say it was not much America had done about it. Lots of people in America still believe it was their fault that they lost, quote-unquote, lost China. And so having lost China, you develop a communist superpower in East Asia. You then, quote-unquote, lose Vietnam. The Brits were fighting brutal communist insurgency in Malaysia at the same time. There was this idea that you may end up with a situation where, you know, Australia would be threatened, you know, India might get... So it was just, communism had to be stopped where it was, and unfortunately where it was in the jungles of Vietnam.
And I think it's probably easy for us to look back with hindsight and question domino theory because it just seems to be the source of so many problems geopolitically for 20, 30, 40 years. But at the time, Dan, was there something in it? Was there a legitimate concern?
I always feel a bit embarrassed, but I mean, it's not my period, so don't like, but I do think there was an element, I guess, of supporting, as it turned out, horrific regimes like the Southern Vietnamese and the Southern South Koreans and the Malaysians, as it turned out. But the idea was eventually you might persuade them to come around to kind of become liberal democracies and sort of bring them into a kind of mature global trading system and stuff. So, and to see them all go one after the other to communists without putting up any kind of resistance, I think did make sense at the time. Who knows what the counterfactual is, but it was just, you know, it was brutal. Vietnam was a a monumental catastrophe for America, and it was born out of this determination that the communists couldn't. They were hoping the French would manage it. It didn't work, so they thought we're just going to have to step in here.
Katie, that's what I think. It's that feels like the double tragedy of Dien Bien Phu. Not only what happened at that battle, but what we know happened afterwards as a result to all those Americans, to those young lads.
It's really frustrating because you just see people, it's just hubris driving the commanders, the leaders of America just to throw the cannon fodder kids right into the line of fire. But just to be completely cheeky, the Vietnamese did get some good French snacks out of the whole situation because baguettes.
They still love their baguettes in Vietnam, don't they?
I mean, that just seems odd to me. I mean, I'm being flippant, but, you know, culturally, they picked up a few expressions. They picked up some food, some snacks. It's interesting how maybe on the soft power side of things, the French could have been a little more convincing and maybe kept the Vietnamese on side.
Well, what's so interesting about soft power, of course, is the first Vietnam is now like a bastion of American capitalism in Asia. I mean, the whole thing's so bonkers.
That's where you get your Nike trainers from.
Yeah, of course. And it's like McDonald's. So this is, and in fact, if anything, Vietnam is now being sort of recruited by the Americans as a bit of a counterweight to, you know, the China's dominance in the region. So, often throughout history, the extension of formal intervention, military control, political control, is so counterproductive. You know, and famously, the Brits, for example, in South America, had an option after the Spanish had been kicked out. The Brits kind of thought, should we take those former colonies over, like Argentina and Chile and. And there was quite a discussion within Britain about that. And they went, no, you're crazy. Just flog them our stuff. Send our experts. And what do you get? You get railways built by the British. You get football being exported and started in Buenos Aires and elsewhere. And actually, South America gets kind of incorporated in so-called informal empire in the 19th century, which is kind of crazy. And you think about what the Americans spent in blood and treasure in Vietnam. But it's just, as you say, hubris.
And to bring it back to the start, Dan, you can actually go to the remnants of Dien Bien Phu now, and it is not quite a holiday attraction, but you can go and walk around it, and you can, if you are Vietnamese, you can celebrate your great victory.
And if you're anyone else, you just sort of look on the mighty in despair, right? I mean, it's just it's a place of where you, it's, if any place on earth symbolises the end of the era of European empire, is Dien Bien Phu. It's a graveyard of empire. So I think, unlike lots of things in this song and other parts of 20th century history that we revere, I think people will still be talking about this place for centuries to come.
Billy did a good thing here, Katie. Billy got it on the nose.
Nailed it.
Cheers, Dan.
Cheers, man.
Super.
Thank you very much.
I feel the hand of history upon our shoulders.
All this tradition of ours, our school history, our songs, this part of the history of our country, all were gone and finished.
There we go, folks. Dien Bien Phu. Thank you very much for listening. What a place, what a story. Remember, if you want more of these episodes, go and look up the rest of the series now. They've got lots of great episodes. Nixon, Eisenhower, Stalin, Marlon Brando, Marilyn Monroe. Billy Joel did a lot of living. Interesting times. And there's a new episode out every Monday, so go and search. We Didn't Start the Fire, or follow, subscribe now. Meanwhile, Dan Snow's History Hit. We'll be back tomorrow. Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History Hit. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.